traces. Perhaps I blinked or shook my head. There's the Salisbury Stonehenge. Its builders couldn't have known the actual trilithon, but the design must reflect some racial memory, myth, legend, likely religion. The trilithon can't be mere coincidence. There could be clues in all the other prehistoric megalithic architecture, in Europe, Egypt, and Peru. But we carry more convincing evidence in ourselves. Our Omegan genes, Derek said. Don't forget, we're part Omegan. There's a lot to think about. She spoke faster, conviction in her voice. That Omegan legacy explains our double nature. Evolution in the jungle selected traits essential for the survival of little family groups. They served our pre-human forebears well enough, but they've become hazards to civilized society. Jealousy, greed, violent aggression. The Omegan genetic engineers overlaid them with the best of themselves. Altruism, love of our fellow beings, love of art and beauty. Our two selves are always in conflict. We enact laws to restrain the primal instincts, teach ethics, and follow religious leaders to find and liberate our Omegan selves. Listening with a puzzled frown, Kenlith had come beside me. I'm sorry, Will. She gave me an apologetic shrug. I didn't mean to preach, but I thought it might keep your spirits up to know the future we hope for. Now, with Kenlith's help, we can learn Omegan history and rewrite human history. We've suffered too many ages of ignorance and error. It should make a difference to us back on Earth to know who we are. It should transform the world. That's our vision. Don't let yourself forget it. The robot was waiting. Awed and humbled by the vision, I promised to remember and tried to say goodbye again. My voice broke. Kenlith looked up at me, tears in his eyes.
I love you, Ty Will. You must be brave.
My own eyes blurred. I turned and let the robot help me stumble into the lock. Efficient and well-instructed, it drove me back up the corkscrew tunnel, past the glistening mosaics I would never see again, out into Alpha's perpetually frigid night. I had one last glimpse of the cluster's clotted stars rising over that flat, white waste of frozen air before the crawler lurched to a different gravity. And something hit me. The crawler seemed to spin. I remember a flash of blinding sunlight, a pang of sickness at the pit of my stomach, another instant of darkness. I'd hoped to see that hollow in the dune where we had found the buried Sahara trilithon. Instead, I came awake, slowly, lying alone on a bed in a small bare room that had high pale green walls. At first my mind was empty, without awareness of whom or where I was or any urge to know. Bits of memory came, shadow shapes that took focus. The trilithons, the worlds we'd seen, Lupe's grand vision of a better future for the world, Kenlith blinking at his tears and calling his quavery farewell. I had no strength at first, no desire to move, but I turned my head at last to look around the room. I found an open door on one side, a wide window on the other. Beyond a strip of white pavement, a velvet lawn sloped down to an arm of blue water ruffled with whitecaps. Smooth hills rose beyond the water, and far mountains hazed with distance. All of it looked Earth-like for a moment, until its strangeness struck me. All the land was velvet smooth, velvet green. I saw no trees, no buildings, no creatures, nothing alive. Two bright suns were rising into a clear blue sky. This was nowhere I had ever been.
Ty Stone?
I'd had too many shocks of wonder, and the strangeness of those words chilled me.
You awake?
The voice was Derek's. But the speaker was a grotesque caricature, built of little metal and crystal bits. It stood at the foot of the bed, glints of rainbow light pulsing slowly through its thousand facets.
You are awake.
Its tone turned positive. T-
Tiber Vargas coming.
Mocking Derek's swinging stride, it left the room. Lupe bustled in. The actual human Lupe. I lay blinking at her, my eyes filled with tears of relief. In a neat white jacket, with a stethoscope hung over her shoulder, she might almost have been a physician back at home.
Will? She gave me a brown grin. Como está?
I don't know. My voice was a rusty whisper. What happened to me?
Heart failure, she said. A latent effect of the virus. You're a lucky dog that it hit you when it did. Back at home, you'd be dead. The robots have had millennia of experience with humans as well as Omegans, and they don't forget.
I lay there trying to digest what she said and finally tried to ask where we were. My voice was only a croak, and she gave me a glass of water.
We call it Theta, she said. The eighth Earth-like planet the Omegans reached. We're in a research station they set up here. They never tried to terraform or settle it because they respected its native life. An odd sort of life. I hope we can come back to see more of it when we're through on Alpha.
You say it's odd?
You see that green stuff?
She nodded at the window.
It covers the ground like skin, eats whatever falls on it. Exists only here in the tropics, I think.
The survey team left maps and specimens and research reports about the rest of the planet that I hope we'll be able to read.
Before we go home, I asked her, how long will it take?
Overcome with a tidal wave of sleep, I didn't hear whatever she said. She must have been impatient to get back to Derek and the mysteries of Omega, but she stayed until she was sure of my recovery. Making the most of her time, she made notes and videos of everything she found at the station and what she could of the world outside.
Derek will be excited with the double sun, she said, and Theta itself will be a bonanza for some future science team. I can't read anything, but there are maps and photos and specimens. Other areas must have other sorts of life biologists will have to see.
My strength came back and a fresh sense of well-being. A day came when she said she had to go.
Derek needs me more than you do.
She kissed me again.
We'll follow you home as soon as we can.
To remake the world?
Huh? Our vision, she shrugged. Sometimes it seems too great to hope for. But we'll do the best we can.
My watch was gone. I don't know how long I was there alone with the robot. Now and then I ventured into other sections of the station, a maze of spaces that I thought were labs or workshops or the quarters of the vanished research team, but there was nothing that made much sense to me. More often I walked outside under the double sun. I found the trilithon behind the station, huge square pillars of black granite towering high, looking as new as when it was just erected. I learned to stay on the white pavement. Once, when I stepped onto the green velvet land cover, a patch of it turned black and flapped to grip my foot until the robot dragged me free. The crawler stood near the trilithon. I asked the robot when it could take me onto Earth.
You wait.
It paused, growing taller and more erect, morphing into a grotesque copy of Ram, even to bright sparks for the crown of worlds on the forehead.
Wait for Tai Chinchi.
Anxiously, I waited. Next day, the robot led me out past our crawler to the trilithon. One moment, I saw only the green velvet slope beyond the pillars. Another instant, and there was another crawler sliding toward me. The lock opened. Ram climbed out. Kenlith came after him and ran to me.
Tai Will, he hugged me. Are you okay?
For a moment, I wasn't sure. The shock of surprise and delight was nearly too much. With no words to say, I stood blinking at them. Kenlith hugged me. Ram grinned and gripped my hand.
We've had enough of Alpha. His shoulders hunched to a bitter shrug. Lupe and Derek love it, but I still get chills when I think about that everlasting darkness and the frozen air. Kenlith had to stay till they learned to operate the tetrahedron, but we left when we could.
You're coming back to Earth?
With a stop on Delta.
He nodded, and I saw a shadow on his face.
I want to look up White Water if we can find him. I'd like to know if Norlan survived a virus, if there's any way to tell. But you are coming home. His lips set, he took a moment to nod. Lupe thought I ought to stay on Delta. Derek wanted to send a team of robots to help me try to restore some kind of civilization. They said it's what I was born to do. But now... His voice trailed off. I glanced at his forehead. The fine white dots of the crown of worlds still shone faintly, even under the double sun. He saw my glance and shook his head again. I can't. He pulled his shoulders straight. With Celia dead, I got no place there. I've got to find another life to live. Remember the girl I met at the Leakey Museum back in Nairobi? We had a great time together. She was fighting AIDS. When Derek and Lupe get back, they should bring Omegan science that could wipe it out. We made no commitments, but I know where she's employed. I'll try to look her up. He shrugged again. I thought he wasn't very happy. That's the best thing I can do. They stayed there an hour, walking around the station and staring off across the green horizons. Ram made a pinhole in a scrap of plastic to show Kenlith an image of the double sun, but he didn't want to go inside the building. I've seen too many Omegan mysteries, he said. They've begun to hurt my head. We went on to Delta. Climbing after him into the crawler, I asked about our destination there. That trilithon above the Blood River? Or the one on Mount Anak? Neither. The robots can open temporary gates anywhere they have good coordinates. They can set us down in Paraclaw. The robot had good coordinates. It set the crawler down and opened the lock. We stepped out on the Fort Blood drill field, black cannon muzzles jutting over our heads. The wind had a chilly bite, and I shivered in the shadow of the huge black blocks in the walls that towered around us. I saw no trilithon. "There only markers," Ram said. "The actual gates are magnetic fields that stretch between the planets." I caught a faint but evil scent on the wind, a thin, bitter reek of death and old decay. Ram made a face, and I was glad to follow him back into the crawler. He gave directions, and the robot drove us out through the white stone palaces of Paraclaw. Still imposing, they were silent, empty, dead. I saw birds in the sky and weeds growing out of mud in the gutters, but nothing else alive. "It feels haunted," Ram seemed to shiver, "haunted by all that died here." He guided the robot to the old Krail mansion. The blood still flowed wide and brown around it, the far banks dark green with returning jungle. But the mansion had the look of ruin, the lawn grown wild and littered with broken tree limbs, the gate knocked down, perhaps by venturesome vandals. We left the robot in the crawler and walked to the door. Ram rapped with the heavy brass knocker. We waited till I felt sure the house was empty, but at last the door swung open. I saw a young woman and heard Ram cry out, "Celia! Celia?" Chapter 38. Of course, she was not Celia, but the resemblance startled me. Standing in the open door, she had Celia's fair face and platinum hair. She had the same fluid flow of expression when she peered in a puzzled way at Ram and then at me.
"I had a sister, Celia," she had her sister's voice. "I believe she died in the blood pandemic. I am Delia Krail."
She looked sharply back at Ram.
"You knew Celia?"
Ram nodded and caught his breath to speak, but she had turned away, staring past us in wonder at the crawler and the robot waiting at the lock, the sun glinting on its thousand polished facets.
"What?" she gasped and looked back at me. "What's that?
"Our vehicle," I said.
vehicle? She gazed at it again. You came here in that?
She shook her head and turned to blink at me.
Who are you? Where did you come from?
From off this planet. She gaped in disbelief, and I tried to tell our story. Her green-gray eyes narrowed as I spoke. Her expressions changed from scorn to shock and dread. She shrank away from me. I thought for a moment that she was about to go back inside and shut the door. But then she looked past us again, at the crawler and the motionless robot.
Celia wrote me.
She spoke slowly, frowning at Ram and then at me.
She wrote about two strangers who told a ridiculous tale that they had come down out of the sky, a white magician and a black that claimed to be a son of the black god Anak.
No, Ram's protest was a husky whisper. Nothing like that.
Lips set tight, she drew farther from us.
There were stories about them before the ship stopped coming.
She seemed not to hear him.
Stories that they had incited the slave rebellion, that they had brought the blood pandemic.
Her tone turned bitter.
They killed my sister.
Glaring at us, she brushed a wisp of that fair hair from her forehead. I saw a mark it had hidden. A little patch of golden freckle had the pattern of the crown of worlds. Ram caught his breath and stood scowling at it.
Please, I begged her. You don't know the facts. If you'll let us explain.
I don't know what you are.
Her voice turned harsh.
I don't want to know.
She went back in the house and shut the door in our faces. Ram strode grimly back toward the crawler. I followed. The robot stepped aside to let us climb in, but Ram stopped outside and turned to me. He seemed dazed, uncertain of anything.
You saw that mark?
I saw, I said. I don't know what to make of it. He glanced back at the house and his face drew harder. He caught his breath.
I don't want to be superstitious, but I don't like what I don't understand. Remember the myth? Sheko murdered Anak. You see how this woman hates me? I don't want a replay. Let's get off the planet while we can.
I felt anxious to get back on Earth, but I had seen no real future there for him. And here was Celia's sister, almost her double, with a birthmark almost identical to his. That left me almost as shaken as he seemed to be, but I groped for logic. Don't be too hasty, I told him. Let's take a minute to think about it. Lupe talked to me about the birthmark back at the hospital. She and Derek have a reasonable scenario.
Reasonable?
He seemed to shiver. It's too uncanny. Well, it seems so to me, I said, but nothing's uncanny to Derek and Lupe. With Kenilith's help, they've begun to decode scraps of Omegan history. There's not much yet, but enough to let them guess about the marks.
So?
He blinked in doubt. Here's their guess, I said. The Omegan engineers must have created several human species that would preserve something of themselves. Sometimes they fail to get the right balance of pre-human and Omegan traits. Lupe thinks they were testing different versions on different planets. That must have taken time. She thinks they died in the middle of the tests with that terrible war still going on. The work wasn't finished. The people we've met here are some of the survivors. So are we, back on Earth, she said. Left to make the best of what we are.
Could be, he shrugged, but still he wore a look of dread. But what about the marks? On the Hotland gods, on my little mama, on me and now Delia Crail. Birthmarks are not hereditary.
He made a bitter face.
I don't like it.
Lupe said Derek has a notion. He believes the birthmarks were genetic markers intended to identify one of the experimental strains. We've got no way to know, but that seems possible to me.
Not to me, he muttered.
Kenilith had been watching from the crawler door.
Can we go on to see the Earth?
He called.
The robot says it's time to go.
It turned to us, sunlight shimmering on its metal and crystal bits, and spoke in a voice that might have been Kenlith's.
"Flight window about to close," it said. "Departure required within 27 minutes, your time."
"I'm ready," Ram seemed relieved. "I want to be human again. Not some weird genetic freak. Not the puppet of any Omegan engineer that died 40,000 years ago. He was on the folding steps climbing in when I heard a shout from the house and saw Whitewater running toward us.
"Wait a minute," he yelled.
"Ty McGrail didn't know you. She wants you to come inside."
"I don't know." Ram blinked uncertainly at me. "I've had too much of her. But Whitewater, he's a man I learned to trust." He turned to ask the robot about the next open window.
"Options are uncertain,"
it told him.
"Planet Earth is remote. The route seldom tested. Stars drift with time. Unused flight congruences may be lost. Coordinates for another flight must be confirmed."
"Then confirmed them." Whitewater came on to meet us. In a faded uniform jacket with a gold button on the breast, he looked unchanged. A spry and wiry little man, his weather-beaten face dark with the black blood that had kept him alive.
"Tai Chenshi, Tai Stone!"
He bowed and moved his hands in the hotland greeting. "I am happy to see you back. Tiba Krail will see you if you will come in."
"Maybe."
Ram shrugged uncertainly, but he returned the gesture and greeting and asked Whitewater how he was.
"Riding the waves the way I always did,"
he waved his arms as if to welcome a brighter future.
"Life's coming back to the river. I'm working now for Tiba Krail."
"She was on Norlan?" I asked. "And the plague never got there?"
"Thanks to all the captains who obeyed orders to scuttle the refugee ships."
He nodded with a bleak grimace.
"It's just lately that anybody came back to find if anybody survived. She was on the first ship to get here. A lady with guts. You'll like her when you get to know her."
He ignored Ram's scowl of doubt.
"You'll be glad to meet the Norlan officials. They're already negotiating with Toron and the Elders. I think they'll agree to most of what you and Toron were asking for. Equal rights and no more slavery."
"Good," Ram muttered. "Not that it matters to me. Not now."
"What matters to us," he said. "Maybe more to the Norlanders. They did survive, but they were hit hard. Enough to tell them how much they need us. But come on in. Tiba Krail is waiting."
We followed him back to the house and found Delia Krail waiting at the door. Her face pale and set, she stood half a minute peering at Ram and gave him a stiffly formal bow. Silently, she led us down the hall. We sat at a table in a small alcove at the end of the big kitchen.
"Oh!"
I heard Kenlith's soft cry and saw him staring. He had seen the little ceramic that had been his mother's sitting on the table. The figures of Anak and Sheko seated on their golden throne. Ram and Delia peered at it and turned to frown at each other. Half a silent minute passed before she spoke.
"Tai Chenshi,"
she asked, her voice hushed,
"will you take off your cap?"
He was wearing a black beret that he'd found in that octagon on Beta. He shrugged and took it off. The crown of worlds shone with a soft golden glow. Her features hardened.
"So that's who you really are,"
the question was quietly accusing.
"The son of Anak."
He gave her a quick little grin.
"If you are Sheko's daughter."
She stiffened as if in anger, but in a moment she relaxed.
"A hot man myth. I heard it from a maid when she'd seen this."
She gestured at her own golden freckle.
"It never bothered me."
The old black cook limped into the room with glasses on a tray and a bottle of Krail's good wine. Delia filled the glasses. Ram took a sip, gave her a grave little smile, and raised his glass in a sort of greeting.
"Ty Whitewater says you just got here?"
2 weeks ago. He saw the ship and came down the channel to guide us to the harbor. I had to come."
Her words flowed out in a sudden torrent. The war killed the colony and left us desperate. A dreadful time. Most of us lost somebody here. Lost investments ruined us all. Food imports were cut off. What was left had to be rationed. For a moment she had Celia's look of bleak endurance in her last days, but then her face softened and she turned with a pale smile for Whitewater.
I was lucky to find him.
The plague? Ram asked her. Are you safe here?
I hope we are,
she nodded.
The doctors think we are.
The pathogen must have died out when no more victims were left to carry it, Whitewater said, but it left us with trouble enough.
I'd be lost without him.
She nodded at him and made a somber face.
You've seen what's left? The total devastation? When I saw the city, I wanted to get back on the ship, but we're trying to restore what we can.
It's hard, but we've begun. He nodded soberly. The Norlanders see how much their lives depended on the colony. Thoron and his people know what Norland can give them. It's civilization, science, technology. The ship's still anchored in the harbor. They're still negotiating. The Norlanders will abolish slavery, promise equal rights for hot men.
Nobody will be coming back without guarantees for us, Delia said. Security and property rights. We're offering plans.
Whitewater nodded.
The Crail Bank can be reopened. Maybe as the Hotland National, if Hotland becomes a nation, there'll be a new currency based on labor value. We need it to pay the liberated slaves who are willing to come back out of the jungle. A lot of them should be. They're dislocated by the war without much food or anything else. With fair pay, I think we can make them happy back at work. The old cook seemed happy enough. Cheerfully, he made a good dinner for us out of the kitchen garden he had grown in the backyard. Whitewater had found a few more of the Crail house servants living in the jungle along the riverbank. The mansion was the only home they had known. Seeming glad to be back, paid by scrip to be redeemed when the new bank opened, they were already cleaning the house and clearing fallen branches and rubbish off the neglected lawns. Kenlith and I were there almost a week, sleeping in the upstairs room that had been our jail. The robot waited in the crawler that still stood in front of the house. Ram spent most of his time with Whitewater and Delia, involved, in spite of himself, in their plans for the Hotland future. One night I heard drum talk, and next day a dugout came down the river carrying Thoron in his bright-colored tribal regalia, accompanied by a small black man in the sober garb of the elderhood. Whitewater took Ram and Delia down to welcome them aboard his launch and carried them down to confer with the Norlan officials in the steamer. Kenlith went down to visit the paddlers waiting in the dugout and came back looking troubled.
They're from somewhere up the Black River, he told me, far up north. They speak a language I couldn't really understand. But they hate Norlanders. They won't come ashore.
He had the cook fill a basket with fruit to give them, but failed again to win any friends. The sun had set before the launch came back up the river. Thoron and the elder got in the dugout and it pulled away. I saw Delia smile at Ram when he offered to help her off the launch. They had begun to get along, but he wore a sober expression.
We have struck a snag. He frowned when I asked how the talks had gone. The Norlanders want a deal, but the elders don't trust them.
Tai Thoron wants Tai Chenchi to stay.
Delia turned to him.
The elders think you came to liberate the slaves. They do trust you. Everybody needs you here.
If that's true.
He gave her a long, searching look. The black beret was off and the crown shone faintly in the dusk. Her eyes fixed on it with a look I couldn't read. They both were silent for a time. He finally nodded. She smiled very gravely, and he turned to me.
Would you mind it, Will? I hate to send you back alone, but I'm really needed here.
Ty, Will, you won't be alone.
Kenlith caught my arm.
I'll be with you if you'll take me.
I put my arm around him and told Ram I understood. Kenlith was eager to see the Earth, yet he and Delia had warmed to each other. Next morning, at breakfast, she was asking him about his mother and his life at Hake's Station. When she saw his solemn glance at the ceramic that had been his mother's, she gave it to him.
"Thank you, Tiber Krail."
He gave her a formal bow.
"You are very kind to me, but I can't take it."
He tried to hand it back to her.
"It was Tiber Celia's." "It's yours,"
she insisted.
"Keep it to remember your mother."
She turned to Ram and me.
"Celia and I kept in touch, but we never really knew each other. Our mother came home to visit her people in Glacier Bay before we were born. She took Celia with her back to Paraclaw. She left me to be adopted by my aunt, her older sister, who wanted me because she had no children of her own."
She smiled at Kenlith.
"It means more to you than to me." "Thank you again, Tiber Krail."
Tears in his eyes, he took it and bowed again.
"You are very generous and very beautiful. As beautiful as your sister. I love you."
Tears in her own eyes, Delia took him in her arms. The drums talked again. Toron was coming back. Whitewater was taking him and Ram upriver to meet with more of the elders and some other tribal leaders. Before they left, Delia wanted to see the country place where their parents and Celia died. They were in the kitchen that morning, packing a basket of food and wine for the trip.
"Ty Will!"
Kenlith burst into the room.
"The robot has a flight window open. We can go!"
Chapter 39. We drove back through the empty avenues of Paraclaw to the empty drill field at Fort Blood. I don't know what the robot did, but the ghost of a trilithon towered suddenly across the sky ahead. We went through it. The sky turned black. My ears clicked. The crawler pitched to the different gravity of Earth and slid down the cusp of that long, brown dune in the Grand Erg Oriental. I found a full moon rising over the square black tops of the twin megaliths, still jutting out of the sand 100 yards behind us. Sandstorms had erased all traces of our camp in the hollow, but the ancient lake bed was still swept bare where Lupe had found that ancient waterhole with its buried bones of early life, and those silicon slivers that must have come from some unlucky cyberoid. The crawler was built for all terrains, but slow. We were 2 nights and a day on our way out of the Erg and onto the Gabbis Road. I had the robot leave us there, standing in the ditch beside it. Kenlith clung to my hand, excited but yet afraid, both of us shivering to a cold desert dawn. Watching the crawler turn and lumber back toward the Erg, I felt suddenly a stranger on Earth, unprepared for what might come. Kenlith seemed eager to know what everything was, peering around the barren landscape behind us and date palms on the horizon ahead of us. He had 1,000 new questions about Earth and my life here, about Tunis, about the roaring machines that ran past us faster than the crawler could move, leaving smoke and a stink in the air. In spite of our raised arms, none of them stopped. The sun grew hot and I began to sweat, but my poker luck ran right. A tourist van screeched to a halt and back to where we stood. A window opened. I heard a shout. My name! A short, bald man jumped out and ran grinning to meet me.
"Professor Stone, you are Professor Stone?"
His bare head was pink with sunburn, but he wore dark glasses. I failed to recognize until he took them off and reached to take my hand.
"Remember me? Ben Sanders? I was in your English 101 a dozen years ago. Somebody told me to inquire about your desert expedition."
He was now teaching history at an Arizona college, and here on a field research expedition with 6 students. Astonished to find us, he shaded his eyes for a sharp squint at Kenlith and asked if we needed help. I told him we'd been waiting for a taxi that had failed to pick us up. I told him I'd stayed in Tunis to look at the site of ancient Carthage and collect background for a seminar on Flaubert's Salammbô. He seemed to accept that, though he took a puzzled look at the odd garments we had found so many light years away. He grinned at them.
"Dressing in Carthaginian style."
I shrugged and left him to wonder about it. He turned to frown at Kenlith, who was keeping very quiet. I said he was a homeless orphan I had found on a Tunis street, with no papers, a history we had to hide, and very little English. He promised to be a problem I hardly knew how to solve. The van had empty seats. I sat beside Sanders all day, listening to the guide's lectures on Tunisian history. From his vague evasions to Sanders' questions, I suspected that he was inventing most of what he said about the Phoenicians and the Greeks, about Rome and Carthage, the Vandals and Venice, the Arabs and the Prophet, the French and General Rommel. The students took dutiful notes and trooped out with cameras to shoot every bit of ancient stonework where we stopped. Though my sense of Earth was coming back, I felt that I'd been away for a lifetime. The city of Tunis was a jolt to me at first, almost as alien as Paraclaw had been. Without Sanders's aid, we'd have been helpless. I said my pocket had been picked. Back at his hotel, he paid for my dinner and persuaded the clerk to let us register, even with no money and no passport. Next morning, he took us to a barber and then to shops where he put new shoes and clothing for us on his own credit card. Officials at the American Embassy were harassed with terrorist threats, security concerns, and the problems of too many tourists. But they helped me get calls through to the university, my lawyer, and my bank. My identity established and my lost plastic replaced, Kenlith was still a problem. Sanders expected me to abandon him. When I refused, he talked to his tour director. The director called people who had the right connections and an appetite for money. It took another day and a few $1,000s, but they provided documentation for Kenlith, complete with an American entry visa. We had a farewell breakfast next morning with Sanders and his students. They were going on to Egypt to see the pyramids, the Aswan Dam, and Luxor. I thanked him, repaid him, and bought air tickets to Lubbock. Back in Portales without my companions, I had to improvise stories for newspapers, faculty friends, university officials, and the campus cops, the state police, and the district attorney, and all the anxious relatives. I kept to actual events until we had reached Tunisia and hired the chopper to take us out over the Erg. The chopper landed us, I said, at the site where Derek's radar had located what he thought were half-buried megaliths. I said we'd found no trace of them. A sandstorm caught us before the pilot returned to pick us up. When the winds died down and we could see again, we set out toward a far-off dune where we thought we saw the chopper waiting. I said we never found it. Never got back to the camp where we had left our food and water. We wandered through the dunes all the burning day and tried to sleep that night. Alone when I woke, I blundered on until heat and thirst overcame me. I said I recalled nothing more until I woke lying in the ditch by the Gabas Road and got a ride on a farm truck back into Tunis. Most people seemed willing to accept the amnesia story. A few were critical. Derek's uncle Daniel was the harshest. He had posted a small fortune in rewards for information and gone twice to Tunis to make his own investigations. He'd looked up our pilot and hired him to fly back over the Erg. They found no sign of our camp, located no second Stonehenge. He'd been fond of Derek, and he suspected foul play. A lawyer himself, and once an assistant district attorney, he kept probing like a prosecutor for all I said I had forgotten. Nothing satisfied him. He tried to interrogate Kenlith, who kept a blank face and said he didn't understand the questions. He grew angry and finally concluded, I think, that I'd damaged my mind with drugs. Kenlith and I are now back in the old house my grandfather built, just a few blocks off the campus. My old faculty friends held a party to welcome me home with drinks enough and no uncomfortable questions. The university has filled my empty slot with a brilliant young Victorian scholar. I've retired to a part-time position that gives me time to write. Next semester, I'll be teaching a graduate seminar on Shakespeare's history plays. Good neighbors had looked after the house and mowed the lawn. My bank kept the bills paid. The old brown brick is far less imposing than the Crail mansion, but Kenneth is happy in the room that used to be my mother's. He has learned more English, learned to ride a bike, made friends with the neighbor kids. Some of them tried to torment him at first for the color of his skin, his odd accent, his silence about where he came from. One day he came home with a black eye. He hadn't hurt anybody, he said, because he didn't want to make trouble for me. I told him to defend himself. He said the kids at Hake Station had taught him how to do it. I was watching from the car the next day when he walked out to join a baseball game on a vacant lot. Three of the bullies left the game to meet him. I couldn't hear what was said, but the brief encounter left one of them flat on his back and the others in flight. They've since become friends, and he's already earning a place on the team. For his sake, as much as my own, I'm still trying to keep the secret of the gate and the far worlds beyond it. The media and scientific skeptics would tear him apart if we tried to tell the truth. I'm going to adopt him. I want him to have a normal boyhood and a chance at a normal life. I'm glad to have him with me here, the child I never had. Yet our old weekly poker nights have left an aching gap. Sometimes, on moonless nights, I stand out in my backyard and search the sky, trying to imagine Ram and Delia working to restore the Grand Dominion, and Derek and Lupe still busy on that runaway planet out beyond the stardust of the Milky Way, recovering Omegan history. The adventure is vivid in my memory. I find a kind of comfort in it. When I feel depressed by news of spreading terror here on Earth and the dread of a dark tide rising to overwhelm civilization, it cheers me to recall that we are the new Omegans, with that magnificent legacy waiting for us. We have survived the death of our first son. Bad times may come, but surely we'll prevail. I wish I'd brought some relic back. One of those Omegan coins, perhaps, or even a magic tetrahedron like Kenlith's. I spend restless nights dreaming that Derek and Lupe have returned, sometimes bringing a diamond-shining, celluform robot to overwhelm the unbelievers. Ram is sometimes with them. Together again, we four horsemen could shake up the planet. That can happen. I don't know when.
This concludes the reading of The Stonehenge Gate by Jack Williamson. Copyright 2005 by Jack Williamson. This book was read by Harlan Ellison.